Welcome to Signals and Synapses, the podcast of the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics in Tübingen, Germany. Here we keep you up to date about what's new in neuroscience. Hear directly from our researchers about how we perceive, decide, learn, and act. I'm Sophia Jans, and today I'm joined by Asaf Breska and Teresa Horn. Asaf is a cognitive neuroscientist here at the MPI for Biological Cybernetics. His research group studies adaptive behavior in dynamic environments. Welcome to this episode, Asaf.
Thank you, Sophia. Thanks for having me.
Teresa is a computational neuroscientist at our MPI and at the University of Tübingen. She will be co-hosting this episode and talk to Asaf about how our brains deal with time. For example, when we learn, predict events, and react to them. Thank you for joining us, Teresa.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we delve into the details of your research, Asaf, can you tell us a bit about the field of cognitive neuroscience?
Yes, so in the field of cognitive neuroscience, it's two words, cognitive and neuroscience, and it's all about understanding the brain and the mind. So the cognitive level is, you can say, the mind or how we think, and the neuroscience level is the brain or how this is implemented in our biology. And what we're trying to do in our field is to understand both levels simultaneously.
So your research focuses more on timing, as we heard in the introduction.
Yes.
How does this, or what are you looking at exactly?
So when we think about the dimensions on which our existence or how we interact with the world is built, a lot of people think about space, right? Where things are in a 3D world. But what is always also there is time, which is the progression, that the way that we experience it with the flow of the arrow of time. And this is something that has been relatively less studied. We less understand how the brain encodes this. We less understand what kind of computations the brain does in order to arrange events on time, perceive time, or use time in a way that helps us to interact with the world.
So in your research, do you focus more on the perception of time or the usage of time?
So we have, there are several levels to our research. So first of all, there is one main distinction, which is between implicit timing and explicit timing. So explicit timing is your ability to say what the time is in terms of judging temporal quantities. So for example, if you say that one duration is longer than the other, right? So if I play to you like beep and beep, you have no problem saying that the latter was longer, right? And this is also true for like more complex temporal structure, like, for example, rhythms, right? So if you listen to a beat that sounds like this, and one that sounds like this, you have no problem saying that the second one was faster, right? So humans are able to do this. And one level in which we try to understand time in our mind and in our brain is how are you able to do this? And on the other hand, you time a lot when you interact with the environment, even without thinking about it. So for example, when you are driving in your car and you see a kid running after a ball towards the road, you can calculate whether you should stop or whether it's okay that you keep driving, although you don't think about it as in, how many seconds do I have? It's just something that you kind of do automatically. Or for example, when someone speaks and takes a break, you know whether this is just a break for air and they're going to keep on talking, or is it like a pause now that you should say something? So these are things that we do all the time, but we don't really think about them in a way that requires cognitive resources or effort.
So you mentioned implicit timing. Now, so, how does this?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that humans do this timing in such different environments that it's not yet clear to scientists whether there is just one type of timing in the brain or these actually two types or more that depends on the context in which you do the timing. So, for example, we talked before about judging whether a beat is fast or slow, but you actually do this all the time without thinking. So think, for example, when you listen to the radio and you start singing with the singer in the chorus, right? Sometimes you can even do this for songs that you have not heard before. Just after hearing one verse and one chorus, you can already sing with the singer. But how do you do that? How are you able to be on time with the singer and not be in delay, right? So you're doing, on the one hand, perceiving and being able to, and perceiving the temporal beats, let's say, but also being able to project it forward such that you are in sync with what's happening in the world. And this is something that really interests us because this is a really essential ability to interact with the world, right? So if I throw a ball at you and you are not going to move your hand predictively to catch it, you're going to get hit in your hand, in your head. If you move it too early, your hand, you're going to miss it. And if you move your hand too late, you're going to miss it. But you cannot just be reactive. You have to, in some way, predict the trajectory of the ball because moving your hand also takes time and perception takes time. So all of these things have to be accounted for by the brain. And the brain is very good at doing that. As we know, most of us can catch something that's thrown to us. So we are really interested in this intersection between timing and prediction that is happening implicitly all the time in almost everything that we do, whether it's listening to speech or talking, watching sports, like it's just interacting with an environment where things change all the time and pretty rapidly. You have to use some kind of prediction to reduce the load or the uncertainty that you have in the environment.
So there's something a little bit confusing for me in your example mm-hmm. about clapping along or singing along with a song. So it seems to me there's also short-term memory involved and not just predicting. So how do you disentangle all of that?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So when we think about the environment in which timing, this kind of temporal tuning takes place, you can broadly separate it into two categories, or at least this is a separation that I like to think in these terms of. One is, do the immediate dynamics of the environment contain some kind of regularity that might help you predict what is going to happen? Or is it something about your past experience, right? So the best example for past experience is a traffic light. So you are standing at a red light and then the red, at least in some countries, switches from red to red, yellow, and then green. So if you've been there before, you know how long it's going to take between the red, yellow, and the green, and you can already prepare yourself to start driving at the right moment. But there's really nothing in the immediate environment that tells you that. So the fact that you're able to do it means that you were able to learn an association between the onset of this red, yellow light and the interval to the green light. So this is something that, when we think of it from a computational perspective, has to rely on some memory of this magnitude, the duration that is associated with this cue, the red, yellow light. But when you think about singing with the radio, the immediate dynamics of the world, what you've just heard, is in kind of way predicting how it's going to continue to unfold. Unless this is a very complex jazz piece that might change pace at any moment, it's usually pretty common that things tend to continue the way that they are. So you can use these kinds of dynamics that are in the environment and project them forward. And one very influential idea is that when you do that, you don't actually need to have a memory of the duration. So it's not that you learn what this time interval is and then project it the same way that you would do for the traffic light, but somehow by having your brain fluctuating, or you can think of it as dancing with the dynamics of the environment, this continuing of this fluctuation is what allows you to be prepared on the right time. And this fluctuation in a more technical term is called oscillation.
Could you elaborate on the oscillations in the brain a bit?
Yeah, so actually a lot of systems also outside of the brain show this behavior of an oscillation. So this is just a fluctuation. Think of a metronome that goes from side to side, or a swing where you push a child and it goes back and forth. So this is a physical principle of systems that get into some specific cycle. And the interesting thing is that this cycle can continue even after the first push that you gave it. And this is why it has a potential as a mechanism for prediction.
And within the brain, what would be the oscillating part here?
So there has been a lot of research that has shown that neural circuits show these oscillations, so these dynamical fluctuations at multiple levels, both at single neurons levels and at more complex network that are interacting with each other. And what is interesting is that these neural fluctuations can have also a functional meaning. So for example, some types of oscillations in some circuits actually are determining the excitability or the sensitivity of the brain for incoming input. So if you think of a sine wave that fluctuates, in some points, let's say the peaks, you are more sensitive, and in the troughs, you are less sensitive. So this can be used as a mechanism to project forward the dynamics of the environment.
So going back to timing, how is this oscillation then directly connected to my perception of time?
Yeah, this is a great question. So this is something that really is a hot topic now, of how exactly are these oscillations come to encode the timing of the world. So let's say that the world, my speech, has some pace, and then there are oscillations at different frequencies in my brain. Maybe the one whose frequency matches the speed, the rate in which I talk, somehow gets aligned with the input that the brain is receiving of me talking. And by that, this oscillation now reflects, or as we say, encodes the dynamics of my speech. And for a different person that speaks faster, maybe an oscillation at a different frequency would be the one that hooks onto that person's speech rate. And then the brain knows whether someone is speaking slow or speaking fast. That is a theory that is being still tested today, but this is how we think about encoding of temporal dynamics. So it's not like a neural state that you can say, if the brain is in this state, then that's what it perceives, but it's something about how the brain evolves over time that reflects how the world unfolds over time.
So if this oscillating mechanism is just a theory, is there a main competing theory to explain prediction phenomena?
Yes. So the alternative, or one alternative to this idea, is something that's much more based on the traffic light example that we mentioned before. That what the brain does is to learn very quickly all of the possible intervals between all types of events, and based on that, build some kind of a map of whatever's happening. I know when the next thing is supposed to come. So it's not really, these kinds of models are not really about some kind of dynamical self-sustaining property of the brain, but about dynamically and very rapidly pulling out of your memory the right interval for the right situation. And this is, for example, where the cerebellum gets into the picture.
So you mentioned the cerebellum. Can you tell us a bit what's that actually?
So the cerebellum is a part of the brain. So it's funny to call it a part because it actually contains more than 50% of the neurons in the brain, but in much less than 50% of the brain volume. So it's a very dense structure. And science has been, like, for years trying to figure out what does this cerebellum do. And in the past, people thought that it has a lot of role in movement, so fine-tuning movement or learning how to ride a bike and all sorts of procedural behaviors. But in recent years, we see that there is new research, for example, from our lab, that shows that the cerebellum is involved in somehow encoding and predicting these isolated intervals. And this is where it becomes a candidate to be this kind of neural system or neural circuit that does this kind of very rapid interval to into some cue in the environment, matching and then predicting.
So this is, I know, which of the two theories you mentioned before now? Is this talking about the oscillation or the memory of specific intervals?
Right. So this is very interesting on whether actually in different environmental contexts, you are using different timing systems. So you could think that when you have this kind of dynamic, very rhythmic environment like music or dance or something like that, it would be efficient to use these oscillations that we know you have in the brain. While when you are in an environment that does not have an immediate preceding context like the traffic light, or that has, but it's not close enough to be a very rhythmic environment, then you will have to use different mechanisms because your oscillations could not help you as much. And then you have to use these alternative timing system or principles, right? And this is now a very contemporary topic that scientists are trying to understand, whether it's really two systems for different contexts, or can it be that one system does it all and we just don't understand yet how? So I'm on the first camp that thinks that there are multiple timing systems in the brain.
Okay, and yeah. So the research where you work with the cerebellum, you use cerebellar lesion patients.
Yes.
Maybe start with explaining why.
Yes, yes. So the problem with studying functions of the cerebellum in humans is that this is a brain structure that is not that easy to measure. So what we do instead is we make a trick. Instead of trying to measure from the cerebellum, we look for people that for some reason their cerebellum is not functioning well. So that could be either due to stroke or due to some genetic condition, a disease that causes that as they age, their cerebellum is functioning less and less. Something like Parkinson's disease, but in a different part of the brain. And then we can take these people, and they are always very happy to collaborate with us and to learn more about their condition and to see what can they do or cannot do. And from that, we learn not only about how to maybe modify their environment so that it's more suitable for what they can do, but we also learn what does the cerebellum do in healthy people. Because if in these people something is not working well, we can infer from this that it's something that the cerebellum usually does.
Connecting to the timing models you have mentioned before. So what processes work in the cerebellar lesion patients and which do not work anymore?
Yeah, great. So this is a really interesting question because it goes straight at our own research, right? So our research has shown that when you test people with cerebellar dysfunction at these kinds of timing environments, you find very strikingly that when you have a rhythmic environment, they have no problem interacting with it, right? So either when they have to judge whether one rhythm is faster than the other, or when they have to use this kind of rhythmic structure to synchronize their behavior or their perception, no problem.
So this is the fitting to the oscillating process.
So that means that actually the cerebellum is not necessary for these oscillations, because these people that have cerebellar damage can still do it. But what they cannot do is the interval timing part. So like the traffic light example, when they have to judge which of two intervals is longer, they do it much worse than healthy, or what we call neurotypical, but age-matched individuals. And when they have to do something like our traffic light example, so they are being exposed to some interval and then they need to use it in a way to optimize their behavior, they are much less efficient in doing that. So this is just measuring their behavior gives us an initial insight that the cerebellum is actually important only in this interval-based behavior, but not in this rhythm oscillation-based behavior.
How do I know that the problem with the interval behavior is not a memory problem, but a timing problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you now, when you have this kind of observation, the question that comes up in terms of the functional organization of information processing is, okay, so we separate this interval from rhythm, but what part of interval timing is it? So one part can be just the ability to time. So maybe the cerebellum is like a clock that you need it to run accurately in order to time. Another possibility is the cerebellum is like the memory bank. So that clock is somewhere else, but the cerebellum is the storage where you put all of this knowledge of what interval relates to what event, and that's kind of your bank. Every time you see the event, you go to the cerebellum, you take out the interval. Or it's possible that the cerebellum is just doing the prediction. So both the clock and the memory are somewhere else, but given a specific interval that you are now know that is about to happen, you need to now somehow prepare yourself for that moment. And maybe that's what the cerebellum is doing. So this is really something that we are working on in the lab right now, trying to understand what exactly is the functional role of the cerebellum.
Could you give us an example how you try to distinguish these roles?
So for example, one thing that we try to do is we try to look across different timing contexts. So for example, we talked in the beginning about explicit and implicit timing. So in implicit timing, you have to predict forward and prepare yourself. In explicit timing, maybe you're not predicting forward, but you're just waiting to see the quantity, right? Like judging which of two intervals is longer. You're just waiting for quantity one, waiting for quantity two, and then comparing them, right? So only one of them has the prediction component. If indeed people with cerebellar damage are impaired in both, then we might be able to conclude that it's not that prediction component, but something else that it's shared between these two operations. And what we find is that when you look at people with different levels of cerebellar dysfunction, so for example, some of them are really, really dysfunctional, and some of them, the cerebellum is still kind of okay, you do find that they are impaired in the same way or to the same extent in these two timing, very different timing behaviors. So if you have very, very severe cerebellum damage, you are bad both at judging which interval is longer and in using interval regularities in order to optimize your behavior. And if you have less cerebellar dysfunction, you are still impaired, but not as much in both.
So when you are saying the implicit timing, using a regularity to predict something, what is this in the experimental context?
Yeah, so Because we can't have people driving while we do our experiments, right? So what we do is we build these computer games where people sit in front of a monitor and they're playing a game. So in our case, the game is showing them one interval and then telling them, okay, now you need to like shoot the target, and the target is going to appear at the same interval as the interval that we've just showed you. So for example, the interval would be like this. 1, 2, and now you're going to get ready, go. And the go, when you have to shoot the target, is going to be usually at the same interval as this cue interval that we've shown you before. And healthy neurotypical individuals are very able to use that kind of information to really prepare their shooting, right? When they press the trigger, to the right moment of the at the same interval. And the way that we can know this is that if we occasionally present the target, the go signal, at another interval, we see that they perform much worse, whether it's being slower to respond to it or whether it's being less able to perceive something that we present at that moment, or sometimes we present something that's very difficult to perceive, and you really have to be focused on the right time to do it. And if you were doing the prediction, that means that you're going to miss it if it's not happening at the time that you expected.
So is there a way to combine the methods, and while you work with these lesion patients and you measure the behavior, the response times, to also simultaneously watch brain activity?
Yes.
Via...
So we actually do this in the lab with EEG. So after seeing the behavioral pattern of selective impairment in the lesions in one context or the other, the next question that interests us is really, can we see some kind of signatures of what is, in our case, the cerebellum contributing to your brain dynamics? So again, in humans at least, we cannot put an electrode in the cerebellum. So if you wanted to do that, you need to work with other species. But what we could do is we could use, for example, EEG, which has very high temporal resolution to measure brain dynamics, to see what are the dynamics of these patients in the cortex. So that's at the outer part of the brain that also does a lot of computations that are about attention and timing and prediction. So determining a lot about your interaction with the environment. And we try to understand the parcellation. What part of the information processing relies on the cerebellum and what part relies on this cortex?
I can see this is super fascinating from a scientific point of view, but is there also in turn a benefit to the patients you're working with?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So we work a lot with individuals that have a genetic disorder. So they were born with it, and at some point they start having the symptoms, and it is very likely that their children will also have it. So we are not conducting clinical research in the way that we are looking for a cure, but we believe that by understanding the principles of information processing, this knowledge can also contribute in the future to understanding how to help these people and their families to have a better life. So whether it is how to adjust their environments to be more suitable for what they can and cannot do. And we hope one day we get to a level of understanding that we can actually do something more concrete in terms of intervention that could help them bring back some of the functions that are impaired. So this could be maybe by some kind of medication that does it, or it could be something that is very common today, which is cognitive training. So instead of trying to chemically fix a problem, you try to have a training protocols like going to the gym for the brain that may help you, if we understand how to do it, bring back or teach the brain how to overcome what is not working, and maybe from a different direction be able to achieve what you want to achieve.
So talking about the future already, let's maybe also take a step back again from the future of this specific research to the future of the field in general. Where do you feel is it going besides hopefully helping these patients?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I think in a broad perspective, one question that has been around since this field has started and is still around is, so how is timing done in the brain? So what is the clock? Where is the clock? What are the principles? And there are different ideas. And for example, some people think that we have an actual clock, like a timer that ticks at some point in the brain. And some people think that it's actually, some time is not really measured in a clock way, but is encoded in some kind of complex network interactions. And I think at least in humans, the breakthrough to move forward with this is that today we have more and more opportunities to actually measure intracranially in humans. So as we said, imaging has slow temporal resolution, and EEG or MEG methods like these measure from outside the brain. So it's really hard for them to find a specific circuit. But today, with the progress of new technologies and new clinical conditions that allow to measure from inside the brain, it's very exciting to think that that might help us find whether there is indeed a clock or something more distributed. So it's not like one part, one circuit in the brain that does it for the whole brain, but it's something that all parts of the brain do, and each of it has its own little clock inside.
Thank you both so much, Asaf and Teresa, for this fascinating discussion. This was Signals and Synapses, today with Asaf Breska and Teresa Horn. If you want to know more about Asaf's research or the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics, follow the links in the show notes. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Signals and Synapses.